This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of September 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Turnout among young Texas voters exploded in 2018, and now groups want to make it even bigger in 2020.
Donors are excited about that. They want to see that continue to grow.
Austin ISD changing its tone on school closures.
He said, we did not do a good job of communicating this to the communities.
And how did Lake Travis's Sometimes Islands get their name?
Is it a boating hazard map made by LCRA or some other organization? Where does the name come from?
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
It's Gretchen Nagy, and I'm the Director of Voter Registration in Travis County.
It was National Voter Registration Day this week, and Travis County had a bit of an announcement about it.
We're seeing a lot of activity, and so much so that we are looking to hit 800,000 registered voters in Travis County by this week.
What percentage is that of the population
total?
Of eligible voters?
It would be around 93.5%.
Wow, that's quite high.
Well, we exceeded 90% back in 2016. So we achieved that and have built on that over the past 3.5 years, and we continue to build on that. It's very positive. We're very proud of that, but it also takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of volunteers, which is what we have in Travis County. We have over 2,700 volunteer deputy registrars who have gone through an hour training, each one. They go to all sorts of events. They generate their own events. They work at events that we generate. We have a lot of partners. And so there's a lot of activity out there.
During last year's midterm elections in Texas, turnout among young voters tripled compared to the previous midterm. And several political groups say they are working to make sure turnout is even bigger in 2020. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports on voter registration efforts targeting young voters ahead of next year's presidential election.
It's early on in the fall semester at UT Austin, and Emily Clark is helping students fill out voter registration forms.
And for that stuff, you can put your driver's license number or the last four of your social.
Clark is a junior at UT. She says getting college students registered isn't always easy. These are largely first-time voters, so there is a lot they don't know. And there's a lot of misconceptions.
And just a lot of them actually think that if they don't have a driver's license from Texas, they can't register to vote here. But that's not true, because as long as you have the last four of your social, you can.
Clark fields questions like these as part of her work with a group called Move Texas. It's a nonprofit working to get young people in the state civically engaged. And that begins with registering them to vote. Charlie Bonner, Move's communications manager, says this work is in high demand these days.
So our budget has increased something near 900% in the past 2 years. And we've added a ton of staff capacity, a ton of field organizers, people out registering voters, engaging them, turning them out. And we're really seeing people start to invest in Texas in a way that they never have before.
Texas has one of the youngest populations in the country. In fact, only Utah, Alaska, and the District of Columbia have younger populations, and not by much. It's projected that by 2022, 1 in 3 voters will be under the age of 30 in Texas. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto with the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin says that's a huge possible share of the electorate.
There's a lot of potential there. Young folks don't tend to register, don't tend to vote at the same rates that older folks do.
In Texas, it's particularly dire. In 2014, just 8% of young people turned out to vote. Ray Martinez works for a youth voter engagement effort called Texas Rising. Martinez says investing in young voters in Texas has largely fallen to nonprofits because campaigns see it as a bad investment.
Sometimes when campaigns come along, the investment in young people isn't as strong as maybe in organizations who primarily serve young people, because campaigns have felt that young people wouldn't, you know, turn up for them.
But things have started to change a little. During the 2018 election, turnout among Texas voters under 30 tripled compared to the previous midterm election. Professor Victoria DeFrancesco Soto says that election signaled some huge shifts.
So 2018 reversed a trend that we'd been seeing in terms of decline in voter turnout among youth and among Latinos.
And she says that change is part of the reason the state also experienced one of the closest statewide elections in decades. Henry Martinez says it also makes it easier to raise money to get even more young people and people of color to vote.
Because of the increase in youth voter participation in 2018, donors are excited about that. They want to see that continue to grow.
With that money, youth registration groups are working to register thousands of young Texas voters ahead of 2020. But Martinez says the increased turnout isn't just about having more money. Martinez says young people are also responding to what's happening in the country, including policies and decisions being made that many of them don't agree with.
There's a lot of bad stuff that's happening right now. I think that people on campus that we're encountering, you know, want to do something. I know that they want to have a say in the political process, and we're seeing just more enthusiasm on campus in general.
For organizers who have been doing this work for a while, this is about more than 2020. Charlie Bonner with Move Texas says this is also about investing in the state's future.
And the thing about being a voter is that once you do it, it's a habit. You know, if we get folks to vote in 2 to 3 elections, they become lifelong voters. And so this election, after that massive growth in 2018, is going to be critical to creating that habit for young voters.
Bonner says this is about making sure Texas's electorate accurately reflects the young and diverse population that lives here. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Traffic deaths in Austin roads are up 20% compared to this time last year. That's even though the Austin City Council adopted a plan called Vision Zero 3 years ago. And Vision Zero aspires to reduce the number of people who die or are seriously injured in traffic crashes to zero. So that's not really happening. And now a new audit from the city auditor's office says the city's transportation department's safety efforts could be better aligned with this Vision Zero goal. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has been following this for us. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Nathan.
What happened? Why are traffic deaths up despite this Vision Zero initiative?
Well, the question of why is hard to answer, and that's what staff with the Austin Transportation Department told city council members. You know, they said they're looking at the data, they're trying to figure this out. But as of now, as you mentioned, traffic deaths on Austin roads are up 20% compared to this time last year.
What has the city been doing to try to reduce traffic deaths and improve traffic safety?
Folks might remember that in 2016, the city of Austin passed what's called a Vision Zero plan, which is basically this long-term traffic safety plan. And as you mentioned, Nathan, it sets a goal of having zero traffic fatalities or serious injuries on Austin roads by 2025. And that plan includes different ideas about how do we educate the public about dangerous driving behaviors? How do we redesign our streets so that they're less dangerous? How do we lower speed limits so that if someone does hit someone, the effects are not as bad? And then also enforcement. How does police enforce, be it speeding or drunk driving, to make sure that our roads are safer? So this audit was specifically focused on education and design, those two parts of what's typically thought of as like a four-part approach to traffic safety. And so when it comes to design, one thing that the auditors noted was that in 2015, the city selected quote-unquote dangerous intersections to redesign so that fewer crashes happen at these intersections. What auditors found is that the intersections that were chosen for redesign didn't experience many severe crashes compared to intersections such as 290 at Springdale, 183 at Lakeline. So these were intersections that auditors said should have perhaps been the focus rather than other intersections that the city chose.
And here's what it sounded like when Kate Murdoch with the city auditor's office made that point to the city council.
ATD has improved 9 intersections since 2015 and is working on another 8. Preliminary data for 4 of these improved intersections suggests there are significantly fewer crashes at 3 of them. However, it is still too early to know the long-term success of these efforts. Despite reducing overall crashes, it appeared, based on documents we reviewed, that few fatal and serious injury crashes had occurred at these intersections prior to the improvements. This makes it unclear if these improvements will help the city reach its Vision Zero goal.
On the educational side of things, mm-hmm. the audit found that the city uses various ways to educate the public about traffic safety, but auditors said the efforts could be better targeted to address dangerous behaviors that frequently result in crashes. What were they talking about?
Something the auditors mentioned is that the city should be running more specific campaigns, education campaigns for the public. And the way they kind of got at this recommendation is that they looked at other cities, for example, Philadelphia, New York, and how they've been handling the education part of Vision Zero. Folks might know that Vision Zero is a really popular model that's been adopted in a lot of cities. Again, it's basically just a long-term traffic safety plan. So they recommended that the city model themselves off of things that a city like Philadelphia has done, for example, which has had just really targeted campaigns, whether it be drunk driving or driving while distracted, and really focusing money and efforts on whether it be PSAs or other marketing campaigns to the public.
Is it realistic to expect that the city is even capable of reducing the number of traffic deaths to zero?
So that was also part of the conversation. The mayor said, quote, I don't think it's unattainable.
I think as technology changes and as education changes and practice changes, I still hope that we get there. I recognize it's not going to be something that happens immediately, but I am real comfortable with that being our goal.
But then staff from Austin Transportation said that it's a goal that's both aspirational
but appropriate moving forward. Picking a different number means we're choosing somebody's family member or friend or neighbor to be a part of that number, and that shouldn't be acceptable. So we are always going to stick with zero.
That was the City Transportation Department's Vision Zero officer, Lewis Leff. What do you make of that, Audrey?
So is that attainable? That's not really for me to answer, but, you know, given that our traffic deaths this year have been going up rather than down, you know, the question is really, did we set a goal that we're never going to be able to reach? And at least some politicians are saying it's attainable, but then staff really don't seem too encouraged by it.
KUT's Audrey McGlinchey joining us to talk about a new report from the Office of the City Auditor in Austin that looks at the city's goal of reducing traffic fatalities and serious injury crashes to zero. Audrey, thank you so much.
Thanks, Nathan.
Ford announced this week that Austin will be its next launch market for self-driving vehicles. KUT's Samuel King reports both the car company and the city believe self-driving vehicles can help address the city's mobility challenges.
Austin will join Miami and Washington, D.C. as Ford's test markets for self-driving vehicles. The company will work with tech firm Argo AI to start mapping Austin streets and gather data about mobility. Austin Assistant Transportation Manager Jason John Michael says self-driving vehicles have the potential to expand access to transportation and make roads safer.
Can I move more people who can't move today? Can I move people more efficiently tomorrow with this service than I can today? Those are some of the questions that I'm very interested in understanding and finding answers to in the eventual future with Ford.
Over the next year, Ford will gradually add testing in areas of East Austin and the downtown core. The company hopes to partner with businesses, nonprofits, and government entities to learn more about how self-driving vehicles could help the region. Samuel King, KUT News.
The first day of fall was this week, but it sure didn't feel like it in Austin. September has brought record-breaking heat to Central Texas, and it's probably not going away anytime soon. KUT's Mose Bouchel reports.
There was a time when it seemed like summer could have gone differently. A wet spring and relatively mild June had us thinking maybe this year wouldn't be so bad. Boy, that didn't last long.
Yeah, we dried out pretty quick, and soil started to dry out, and so we had very, very warm and very, very dry as we entered July, and, you know, things got really bad in August.
Brett Williams is with the National Weather Service. He expects above-average heat into December and says this September is solidly on track to be the hottest ever in Austin, breaking a new record with 17 triple-digit days so far. All put together, the city's had 55 triple-digit days this year.
We're currently sitting in fifth overall all-time for 100-degree days.
Climatologists expect the city to keep getting hotter thanks to climate change. One report out this summer forecasted that the feels-like temperature could start to surpass 127 degrees by the mid-part of the century if nothing is done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
Austin Mayor Steve Adler sees a plan for Austin to do a better job of enforcing rules on sitting, lying down, and camping in public without further action from the Austin City Council. KUT's Andrew Weber has that.
Adler said City Council doesn't necessarily have to forge ahead with a vote to reinstate some restrictions that was planned for October 17th. Council members were set to vote on those restrictions last week, but couldn't reach a consensus. Now Adler is suggesting that the city lean on Austin City Manager Spencer Kronk and the Austin Police Department to enforce existing rules, including a public awareness campaign to urge people to call 911 if they see lewd or aggressive behavior. Adler also suggested rolling out training bulletins for police officers that could clear up confusion on the part of APD. He suggests a 4-foot clearance area be applied to sidewalks and a 6-foot clearance area on entrances to buildings. Adler also called on the manager to post signs at potentially dangerous camping areas along roadways and suggested the city work to clean up the area around the Austin Resource Center for the Homeless. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Travis County's rolling out a new voting machine for this November's elections. KUT's Sangeeta Menon reports the county has set up a series of events to let voters try out the new system before they get to the polls.
The system will still have an electronic ballot marking device to make selections for candidates and propositions, but now voters will get a printout of their choices. After they verify the printout accurately captures their choices, they drop the paper into a ballot box, which will electronically scan the paper to quickly tally the results on election night. And the physical paper ballots will be used to verify those electronic results. Travis County Clerk Dana DeBeauvoir.
This whole system is completely dependent upon voters actually reading their ballot card, determining if, in fact, the human readable text on this is their correct and true ballot choices.
A list of times and locations for voters to try out the new system can be found at KUT.org. Sangeeta Menon, KUT News.
This week, the Austin Independent School District began holding a series of public meetings at schools affected by its proposal to close and consolidate 12 campuses across the district. These have been the first meetings AISD has hosted with parents after it proposed these dramatic changes throughout the district. Tomorrow, AISD is holding a district-wide meeting at Austin High School from noon to 2. Anyone can show up. KUT's Claire McInerney has attended all of the meetings so far. That's a lot of meetings.
It's been a journey.
How has AISD's tone changed throughout these meetings?
Night and day throughout the week. First two meetings earlier in the week, people walked in, they had a PowerPoint, they had this plan to try and break into small groups, and P's parents pushed back on that, same with Met's people. And then Wednesday morning when I showed up, they had put chairs in a circle, and they had a new moderator who didn't quite work on this plan, and it changed dramatically. But the biggest shift was Wednesday night at Webb Middle School. Matias Segura, who was kind of the architect of this plan, apologized, which we haven't heard. And this is what he said. I don't have tape of it, but he said, "We did not do a good job of communicating this to the communities. We are very, very sorry for the hurt we caused, and we are committed to improving." And that came after a bunch of Webb parents were saying, "We didn't even know we were being considered. We found out on the news. We didn't know if that was a rumor." And so they admitted that we didn't do this outreach before the plan was submitted and put out into the world. And now they're kind of backtracking, saying, "Now we want your input. Like, let's do this together."
Well, it sounds like a lot of people had questions about why their schools were chosen and what the process was to choose which schools would be closed.
If I had to guess, I would say most parents don't feel like they got a satisfying answer after this week to that question. You know, the district saying it wasn't just data, and, you know, it seems that that's the case because some people kept saying, like, "But our scores are good," or "Another school's building is worse off than ours," or, you know, this, that, or the other. And the district kept saying, "Yeah, but it wasn't just about one of those things. We tried to consider a lot," but they haven't gone at each school and said, "So here's why Brook Elementary is on the list. It was this, 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 and this." They haven't really done that. And then, you know, some people were saying, "We passed this bond in 2017 because we heard this will make the schools better. So now we feel tricked." A parent I talked to who's a Brook Elementary parent, Margaret Perez, said she felt tricked because a few years ago, Brooke was kind of on a list for closure, and the district said, "Hey, if you can get your enrollment up, we won't consider you for closure."
Like almost 100 more. I mean, it's not just like, "Oh, we made it by like one or two." Our goal, we exceeded that goal. So it's just really disheartening.
So they saw increased enrollment, so she's confused, why us now? So there's just a lot of feeling like there wasn't transparency.
What are parents' thoughts on this proposal, the idea that AISD is going to be modernizing schools and making the buildings where campuses are consolidated, making those buildings better?
This is one of those things that everybody doesn't want. I don't know if it's happening because of a closure, but all the families at every school I went to this week said, we don't care about a new building. We like our teachers and we like our programs and like we don't care that it's kind of old. The district countered saying, yeah, but this isn't really productive. And so this morning at Maplewood, I heard an example that earlier this year, the AC went out, the principal walked in, and she had to spend the whole day calling the district, dealing with a work order, dealing with the guy who came out. And the person from AISD said, and you know what she didn't do that day? Work with her teachers, coach her teachers, make a plan for the next couple of weeks. She didn't do anything that helped the students because she was working with something that's very old. And so their whole goal of these modernizations is to remove that stuff from the table. But it just seems that there's a huge divide on that issue between the parents and the district. The district's goal with this is more modernized buildings. You know, because if you go to new school districts like Manor and Round Rock and stuff, their buildings are drastically different than AISD. And so AISD is trying to match that. And another point they kept saying was teacher salaries and then repairs come from the same pot of money. Yes, we get bond money every once in a while, but
that can't go to maintenance and operations, right?
Yeah. And so they're saying, like, if we have to go and fix an AC a couple times a year, that takes out of the same pot of money that we pay our teachers with. And so they're like, we're making this choice of not doing that and trying to invest more in the people.
Like I mentioned, you went to all of these campus level meetings this week, and the schools that you went to vary quite a bit in their demographic makeup. And I'm wondering if you saw any differences in terms of the conversation or the concerns that parents had.
Yeah, at Sims Elementary, Brook Elementary, and Webb Middle School, there was a lot of conversation around transportation. So I heard, you know, parents saying, I don't have a car. Right now I can walk to school. If I go to this new school, are you going to give me a bus? It's going to be a little murky. It's going to be case by case because the policy is if you live less than 2 miles away from your school, you don't get a bus. So these parents without cars are choosing to live near a school that they can walk to. And so they're feeling like that leaves them in a bad spot. You know, this one woman who I talked to, Manuela Cisneros, is a former parent at Webb. And she was saying, if you don't give some of our kids a bus, it'll take them 3 Cap Metro buses to get to the new school.
How are y'all going to transfer children from Dobie, Webb to Dobie if it does, the change does happen?
There was a big difference with the Pease and Maplewood parents. They came in really asking for, like, what's that data point? Why have something else that counters that? I'd also say the difference was at the other schools, there were Spanish translations. So we had to stop and take a pause after people spoke. So it felt more of a conversation where the energy felt really ramped up with Pease and Maplewood, especially at the beginning, as people's emotions were just coming out in their first opportunity to talk.
I know there were a lot of questions about the timeline and the timing of all this. What is the timeline and what are you hearing from parents about it?
Right now, the board has said that they will vote on this in November. And so they're also saying they're going to do a second draft. And so that would come out in a couple weeks. And people are saying, slow the timeline down, because if you're going to do a new draft and affect different communities, they'll want to talk to you. Maybe you'll get pushed back. But so far right now, it's just November. So some people are saying just push it back. Another popular thing was, what's the timeline then if we are chosen for closure? And so this is Maplewood parent Jamie DeBorek, who was saying, okay, so if Maplewood closes the new modernized school when it opened for a couple years, what's going on in those next couple years?
I wonder about what happens when we do transition and Campbell will be overcrowded from day one. So what's going to happen? What's the, like, are there just going to be 10 more portables thrown in Campbell? What's actually going to happen to that?
And that's valid. Parents want to know what's going to happen day to day for my kid, because the district has not laid out a plan and strategies for helping schools combine. That's something that they said, we hear you. And to all of these questions, the district was really saying, we are listening to you. We're going to do a second draft. This isn't a done deal. And so we'll kind of see what that second draft looks like and if any of this stuff is included.
KUT's Claire McInerney joining us. She's attended all of the public meetings held this week by the Austin Independent School District at campuses affected by AISD's proposal to close and consolidate 12 campuses. You can find a schedule of where the next meetings are taking place at KUT.org. There is a district-wide meeting happening tomorrow from noon to 2 at Austin High School. Thanks so much for this, Claire.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Hotter temperatures, stronger storms, longer droughts. Climate change caused by humans presents an enormous challenge for the planet, and especially the people who live on it. Young people are taking a bigger role in the debate. Last week on this podcast, we heard from some of the teenagers in Austin who organized a climate strike at the Capitol. Well, one Austin teacher is going to the ends of the earth to try to give his students the tools they need to understand what's happening to our climate and why it's happening. His name is David Walker. He's a science teacher at the Liberal Arts and Science Academy in Austin, and he spent part of his summer vacation in the Arctic Circle, this place called Tulik Field Station. So this was in June, and we asked him to keep an audio diary of his time there.
It is June the 14th at about 7:10 p.m. It's been kind of a dreary day, and it finally cleared up a little bit, still overcast, so I've gone on a walk outside my weather port, which is basically a glorified tent setup, and I'm looking for birds on the tundra.
I think that every person, including me, when you think of the Arctic, you're thinking of what really is probably Antarctica. You're thinking of something that's an icy, frozen thing.
That's an American tree sparrow.
Where I was, which is called the North Slope of Alaska, in the summer, it's beautiful. There's hardly any snow. It's green.
And that was a white-crowned sparrow.
They had one of the earliest ice-free dates this year, which means Tulik Lake had no more ice on it this year. So when I got up there, the lake was completely thawed. There was no ice anywhere. So climate change is happening at over double the rate in Arctic regions that it's happening around the world. Over the past 30 years, every decade, temperatures are increasing in the Arctic by around 1 degree Fahrenheit. So an increase in temperature of that much equates to around 1 million square miles of permafrost thaw. And when permafrost thaws, it releases a ton of carbon that's been previously locked up in permafrost. This is a huge carbon reservoir, and with global warming, it's thawing. The carbon reservoir is being released into Arctic watersheds, broken down by sunlight and microbes into carbon dioxide, which yields more global warming, which yields more permafrost thaw, and they call this a positive feedback loop. More carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more global warming, more permafrost thaws, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more global warming, and then it keeps cycling like that, cycling like that, cycling like that, cycling.
It is June 15th at around 9:20 in the morning, and we are out here at Imnaviat Creek, which is just north of Tulik Field Station. What we're going to be doing is measuring thaw depth.
What thaw depth measurements do is you stick a probe into the ground, which is basically a metal stick that has measurements on it. And when that probe hits solid soil, you look at the measurement and see how deep that thaw depth is.
It feels like frozen soil to me, but this is only my second time. Oh, it felt hard.
What they found in the area that we were studying is that thaw depth has, on average, over summer seasons, increased steadily. Over the past 30 years, which is a pretty remarkable piece of evidence in line with the fact that climate change is happening at amplified rates in the Arctic, because you can actually see this change over, you know, the past 10 years. So the first 3 days I was there, we spent digging these huge permafrost pits. It's hard stuff. You have to use a jackhammer to get down into permafrost. We're doing these huge pits. And then they take samples from the surface matter active layer material. And then they take samples from the permafrost.
In the background, you can hear the sounds of Dr. George Kling using a hammer and a chisel to break apart soil samples from the wet sedge tundra. We are going to first weigh them and then place these samples in buckets.
add some water.
And then you make a permafrost tea or surface mat tea from those, which is a simple sort of, it's just like brewing tea at your house. You put permafrost soil or surface mat soil in a bunch of water and let it sit for a while. So it'd be kind of like a cold brew coffee.
Carl Romanowitz, graduate student from University of Michigan, is adding frozen samples from the surface mat layer at Sedge Tundra to the scale. Make sure we get a good amount to begin the solid liquid extraction process. Okay, it is June 20th, just after 3 p.m., and you're listening to the sounds of a vacuum pump. And what I'm doing here with Dr. Rose Corey, actually she's doing the doing and I'm observing, is we are passing permafrost tea through a column to grab out all of the dissolved organic material.
What they're really trying to figure out is what role sunlight plays, what role microbes play in breaking down the dissolved organic material released from these soil types.
Running through the column, you can see slowly over time the column gets darker and darker and darker.
The main issue and why it matters to us is our current climate models don't effectively account for that permafrost feedback loop, because we don't know how quickly it's happening and we don't know what specific factors are responsible for converting the dissolved organic carbon into carbon dioxide. With this work, what that'll eventually hopefully yield is a more updated climate model saying, hey, we've now incorporated this permafrost positive feedback loop into our climate models. We now project that temperatures will increase by this much by this date. And then that'll eventually be conveyed to politicians to better affect change in terms of, you know, emission standards and things like that. That's one of the things about this work, is that the results are both exciting and terrifying at the same time, right? When you figure out, wow, sunlight is playing a huge role in breaking down the carbon that's released from permafrost into carbon dioxide. That's an exciting piece of information, but it's also terrifying because sunlight is very important in the Arctic, 24 hours of sunlight each summer. And the fact that it's doing that much to convert the carbon into carbon dioxide is scary. You know, we have a model of climate change right now that is terrifying already. It's going to get worse when we fully realize the amount that thawing permafrost is contributing to it.
Okay, it is Friday, September the 13th, 4:18 in the afternoon. Just finished a Friday of teaching here at Lhasa High School. And I've been working on this semester and I'm going to continue to work on trying to incorporate the research I learned about in the Arctic into activities and projects for my students so that they can learn more about climate science and about how the world is changing at a much faster pace in the Arctic than it is here in Texas. Question. Can you theoretically draw a resonance contributor for this molecule? Take a look at it. What do you think?
In academia, there's no real debate on climate change, especially in the science classroom. That's the way I present it in class. That's what we accept as a classroom. And I think that one of my roles is as a teacher is to convey the immediacy of this issue, one that operates on a timescale that humans are not used to interpreting.
So I was like doodling around in chemistry rooms last year and I saw people drawing out resonance contributors and things like that. And so maybe
my students are going to be on the front lines of this. And it's really their generation that's arguably more important than ours in terms of where this goes. Whether they're scientists, politicians, engineers, whatever career they're in, a comprehensive knowledge of this is very important. And so if I can bring them firsthand knowledge, both what I've seen and also the scientists with whom I've interacted that are working up there while we're in class down here, I think that that brings a level of immediacy to the issue.
You can find out more about David Walker's trip to the Arctic and the research being done at KUT.org. This piece was produced by KUT's Matt Largie. This week, we learned more about the circumstances that allowed a man with an arrest warrant to buy a rifle from an Austin firearms dealer. This man was later arrested in Pease Park in central Austin, where he had stashed that AR-15 type rifle just before the arrest. 23-year-old Dalton Broche, and he was charged with unlawfully carrying concealed weapons. He had a handgun and a retractable club. Texas Department of Public Safety Deputy Director Skylar Hearn testified for a Texas Senate committee this week that while Broche had an active arrest warrant, he had no other disqualifications.
The FBI delayed that purchase while they reached out to see if that case was moving in a prosecutorial fashion, if there was an information or indictment on that case. And when there was not one, they had to approve the purchase.
So someone with a felony assault charge was able to buy a firearm. And it's an issue where people on both sides of the gun debate have some common ground. Allie Morris is a Texas legislative reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Allie, thank you for coming to KUT.
Thanks for having me.
What more have you learned about this firearm purchase by Dalton Broche?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting case that I think surprised a lot of people, even those who work in gun stores. So as you mentioned, he had an arrest warrant out for a pretty serious charge of threatening to stab his stepfather. That was filed in early July, and still a month later, he went in and bought a gun. After his arrest in Pease Park, I think there was a lot of confusion about how he was able to access a firearm. And what's come out is that there was a 2017 federal rule change that basically changed who is considered a fugitive from justice. Now, those people who are considered fugitives cannot buy weapons legally under federal law. And before 2017, anyone with an outstanding arrest warrant would have fallen into that category. But a change in 2017 said that unless you had fled across state lines, so you were wanted in Texas and went to Oklahoma or Louisiana, if that wasn't the case, you could still buy a gun. And so that is what ultimately happened with this 23-year-old here in Austin.
Well, now that it has caught the attention of state lawmakers, what are they saying about it?
Yeah, you know, a lot of Democrats have been pushing for a special session, and this is one area where they say, we didn't know about this, and we think this should be fixed. And, you know, experts at the federal level say, since this had been the policy for so long to deny anyone with an arrest warrant access to a gun, a lot of states haven't taken the step on their own to actually address this issue. And so Democrats and even some Republicans and at least one gun shop owner in Austin are saying this is something that should be dealt with.
I wanted to ask you about that because in your story, you report about even members of the gun rights community agreeing with that. What is the Texas State Rifle Association, for example, saying?
Yeah, I talked with their legislative affairs director, and he and I think a lot of people in the community say dangerous individuals shouldn't have access to a firearm. And so, you know, he told me that if you're accused of a violent crime, if there's an arrest warrant, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun until that gets cleared up.
So many people agree on this across the spectrum of debate. What are the odds of something happening with respect to legislation?
That's a great question. The Texas legislature won't meet again until 2021, until after the next election, which is pretty far away. So far, the governor has been hesitant to call a special session to bring lawmakers back to Austin to tackle gun safety issues. So it's really kind of up in the air. And if the 2020 election produces, you know, any big changes, then we could see some of these issues, the political reality around them, change when lawmakers come back in 2021.
Allie Morris is a Texas legislative reporter for the San Antonio Express News. You can read her story about this at expressnews.com. Allie, thanks for coming to KUT.
Thank you.
A favorite way for a lot of people in Austin to escape the scalding Texas summer heat is to take a dip in Lake Travis. Each summer, more than 200,000 people make the trip to the 63-mile-long body of water. But there's one part of the lake that puzzled a KUT listener. So as part of our AT Explained project, we sent Tiana Woodard out to answer the question.
The mystery in question are the appearance and disappearance of the Sometimes Islands. The small string of land is located off Mansfield Park in the eastern part of Lake Travis.
I've seen the so-called Sometimes Islands, but I don't go out there very often.
Robert Baumgartner has lived in the Austin area since graduating from UT Austin in 1979. He first heard about the islands on a local news forecast, and he thinks he knows how they got their name.
I think somebody read that off of a navigation chart, maybe a map made by LCRA or whoever does navigation hazards for the lakes in Texas. And because those islands are not there permanently, somebody just in shorthand put sometimes islands, meaning that they're a navigation hazard sometimes to boats.
Baumgartner wrote into KUT's AT Explained project in hopes of definitely finding out how the islands got their name.
Is it a boating hazard map made by LCRA or some other organization? Where does the name come from?
Because of their location off of Mansfield Dam, the Sometimes Islands lie under the Lower Colorado River Authority's jurisdiction. So it makes sense to go to the people who operate and manage the waters, right? I met up with LCRA communications specialist Patrick Badgley at Tom Miller Dam here in Austin. Although little information remains in their record about the landmass name's origins, Badgley and the LCRA stick to the common explanation.
What gives it its name is the fact that when Lake Travis is high, it's not clearly visible. The geologic formation isn't clearly visible, but when it's low, you can see it. So hence the sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't.
Okay, now I know the reason for the name, but I also wanted to know when people started using that name.
This is from 1959, and you can see the location of the dam and the lake.
Mike Miller is the Austin History Center's managing archivist, but his expertise lies in cartography. So when I walked into his office, he already had two large topographical maps of Lake Travis pulled out for me. He says the Sometimes Islands appear because of the uneven topography of the land underneath the water, which was formerly called Horseshoe Bend.
It looks exactly like a horseshoe, with the dam on 1 foot of the shoe, basically. And the land that's in the middle of that horseshoe, of course, is much higher than the river valley, the riverbed, you know, underneath it.
Miller guesses the creation of the name was sometime in the 1950s and 60s, when the county was hit by a major drought.
And so those were probably the first times after the formation of the lake that the water levels dropped to a point where the islands would appear.
Miller says the earliest usage of the name he could find in their records was from a newspaper article from the 1970s. But finding name origins is rare.
You're never going to find that smoking gun that says, you know, I'm so-and-so and I named this piece by this name, you know, so let it be written, so let it be done. It's lore, it's, you know, it's oral, it's passed down from person to person, and then it kind of sticks.
And Miller says once a name sticks, it's hard for cartographers to figure out the when and why and how the name came to be.
Maybe that's what happens sometimes, islands.
If you want to check out the islands for yourself, and maybe even give them your own personal name, you're out of luck. Even though we've had a brutally hot and dry summer, Austin's spring was pretty wet. For now, the lake levels are just too high. Tiana Woodard, KUT News.
Much more in our AT Explained series at atexplained.org. Subscribe to the podcast to catch up on all the questions we've answered, or you can even ask your own there. That's atexplained.org. That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of September 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.